is a South African by birth and by nationality, but he grew up in Zimbabwe. He was at school in Zimbabwe. His first degree, BSc, was at the University of Zimbabwe, and a master of an MPhil degree in zoology at the University of Zimbabwe. And then eventually a PhD at Witwatersrand University in South Africa, a PhD in resource ecology. He is a research scientist. He is a resource ecologist. I suppose one would say more accurately that he is a fish population ecologist. He has worked in a number of settings as a research scientist in the Department of National Parks and Wildlife Management in Zimbabwe, in the National Institute for Water Research in South Africa, in the Fisheries Research Institute in South Africa, and since 1995, in Rome, for the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organizations, with responsibilities for fisheries in the Caribbean region and in the southeastern Atlantic. As I look over Dr. Cochrane's CV and muse about it a little, I'm struck really by three things. First is that he obviously is a very good resource scientist. His CV is long, his publications are numerous. Second, he is obviously a scientist with a very well-developed social conscience. In the late 1980s, for example, when things were particularly turbulent in South Africa, he took a couple of years away from science to work for the Episcopal Church in a Justice and Reconciliation Committee. And the other thing that strikes me is just how difficult the type of work he's trying to do is. He's trying to balance. In his thought and in his writing, he's trying to balance the ecological requirements associated with a sustainable fishery with the economic demands that are placed on that fishery, and all of this in a state of very imperfect knowledge about the world's oceans and the world's fish. It's a complex juggling act, and I suppose in a way fisheries provides a clear example of a type of problem that's exceedingly widespread around the world today, a clearer example than one would find in many other settings. But the fishery example is a particularly important one, perhaps for us here in British Columbia. As you're all aware, we've just in the last few days made some quite striking changes in our own laws with respect to fisheries, opening up the licensing of fish farms much more freely than previously, and that within, again, a state of very imperfect knowledge about the state of our fish stocks. So these are basic and important questions with wide-ranging implications. Dr. Cochrane, we welcome you here tonight. We look forward to what you have to say. There's your topic. What you want is what you get. A fishy look at the limitations of science. The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you very much for that introduction. It's indeed a great pleasure and an honor to be here this evening. And I'd like to start by thanking those who have made it possible, in particular Green College and the principal, Richard Erickson, Roseanne Rumley, who's been extremely helpful and welcoming, and the students and staff of Green College, who have welcomed my wife, Hilary, and I, who have been most hospitable and very friendly in all possible ways. I'd also like to thank the Fisheries Center and, again, in particular, the director, Tony Pitcher, and Melanie Powers, both of whom worked very hard on my behalf to make this visit possible. Hilary and I are here for a period of 3 months as Green College visiting professor, And for us, it's a really refreshing break in a very stimulating environment here on campus, and also a very peaceful and beautiful environment. But one of the things I think we've both found most refreshing so far is to have it reaffirmed in being surrounded by young people, or at least young relative to us, by young people, that the young people of today are still optimistic, they're still enthusiastic, and perhaps most importantly of all, they're still very skeptical of the thoughts and views of the older generation. And I think without those three characteristics amongst our younger people, amongst our students, the future would be fairly bleak. It's encouraging to see that Green College, the University of British Columbia, and Vancouver as a whole are ensuring a continued supply of such alert and critical young people. Let me move on now, but before getting on to my talk, if I can get anywhere, on the topic, I would just like to say a little bit about what the Food and Agricultural Organization is. I found that most people know quite a lot about the functioning and the role of the United Nations as a whole, but there's far less knowledge of the functioning of its specialized agencies. And the Food and Agricultural Organization is one of those specialized agencies. It was founded in 1945, just after the Second World War, and one of its prime functions then was to assist in the agricultural rebuilding of Europe after the destruction of the Second World War. Italy was one of the countries that was hit hardest by that war, and hence the decision to locate the headquarters in Rome. What's very important about the organization is that it is not the people such as myself, the members of staff. There are about 2,500 of us based in Rome. We're simply there to serve the organization, and the organization itself is the 183 member countries. They are the ones who make the decisions. They are the ones who ultimately must implement the actions. And of course, Canada is one of the members of that organization. The aim of the FAO, as defined at present, still consistent with its original intention, was to meet the needs of both present and future generations by promoting development that does not degrade the environment, is technically appropriate, economically viable, and socially acceptable. In looking at that mission, we need to bear in mind that at present, there are some 800 million people in this world who are undernourished. That's about one-sixth of the world's population. In addition to that, there are about 12 million children under five who die each year unnecessarily. That's equivalent to the entire population of Canada dying every 3 years, but in children under five. We have a tremendous amount of work to do in order to bring those people up to acceptable standards and to bring up the even more hundreds of millions of people just above that level, to levels that we in this room would consider reasonable standards of living. The FAO, in the form of its 183 member countries, clearly have a lot of ground to make up. Getting on to the talk itself, the title probably sounds very esoteric and quite a long way from the subjects of poverty and starvation that I've just been referring to, but in fact, as I'm sure you will appreciate, in fact, it's not. We have, with our current standards of living, we've already put our environment under considerable stress. We've overexploited many resources. We've resulted in whole systems being pushed beyond their limits, some being driven to collapse. If we want to try and redress this, if we want to try and get back to sustainable and productive ecological systems, sustainable and productive human systems, we're going to need a lot of scientific information. When we try and do that, when we try and restore our natural systems while at the same time increasing the living standards of 800 million people and at the same time maintaining the living standards of the privileged remainder, we have an even harder task. What I would like to address today is what we can expect from science in addressing that task. What we can look to from science, and what we cannot expect from science. And partially what motivates this talk is a growing awareness after the years I've spent in science that many people expect too much from it. Many people look to it to provide answers for which there are no answers. Many people look to it to make decisions when in fact those decisions have to be made by people. And I hope I will illustrate that during this talk. So I'm breaking it down into, first of all, just very briefly looking at the problems being experienced in fisheries and some of the fundamental causes. How science is used within fisheries, and in doing that I'll deviate slightly and discuss what science is. Then start looking at the limitations, and that would be looking at the bias and the uncertainty that are intrinsic to science. And then to bring it down to earth, just have a look at two case studies where science has both been used and has run out a bit of steam, and then see where we get to from there. So starting with the problems in fisheries, and coming to Canada, I probably don't have to go into much detail on this. I think Canada is very aware of its fisheries. The fisheries seem to be an important part of your culture and your souls. And with the recent collapse of the Canadian cod fishery, it's obviously a very sensitive topic. What's happened here and what happened to the Canadian cod fishery is not unusual, however, and it's happened again and again in fisheries throughout the world, perhaps less dramatically, perhaps less apparently suddenly, but it has happened. And if we look at the fisheries of the European community, many of them are in a very bad state as well. If we look at the hake fishery shared by Uruguay and Argentina, it's similar. If you go to the fisheries, coastal fisheries around Africa, around Southeast Asia, everywhere you will find evidence that we are pushing our marine systems, our aquatic systems, too hard. A part of that is that now there are just too many fishing boats and too many fishermen trying to take those fish. Excessive fishing capacity is a huge problem in the world fisheries. It forms a pressure that encourages governments to go on fishing because they have all these vessels, all these fishermen looking for something to do. That overfishing degrades the food production potential of the environment, and in addition, it all leads to economic waste, and we cannot afford economic or any other waste in our world. And then linked to that is the social disruption that is happening in fisheries, and again, the Canadian cod is one of the more dramatic and well-documented examples of that, where, if I remember rightly, something like 25,000 people were made unemployed very suddenly by a collapse of a fishery. Again, that happens perhaps less dramatically in many other parts of the world, and perhaps in a more sinister way, because in so many other parts of the world, there isn't social security to give them an alternative. So instead of closing a fishery, the fishery simply continues, but taking less and less, and the people slip further and further into poverty and into need. So that's what we're looking at in fisheries today. What are the causes of those problems? And obviously those differ markedly from fishery to fishery, from ecosystem to ecosystem. But when we look across all the fisheries that have experienced problems, we find there are common themes. And one of the common themes is ecological uncertainty, biological uncertainty. We know so little about what's happening in our marine systems. They're dynamic, they're diverse, they're invisible to a large extent. So we're only getting a vague picture, a shadow of what's actually happening, and that makes management extremely difficult. A second problem, a pervasive problem in many areas of natural resource use, is that history shows us that time and time again, when there is a conflict between taking long-term biological decisions or short-term social and economic or considering short-term and economic needs, those will take priority. No matter what the intentions of the individuals concerned, when it comes to a crunch, the current debts, needing to keep employment up, needing to keep the shareholders satisfied, that will be the thing that drives the decision today. People will decide, well, let's leave the hard decision till next year. Maybe next year will be better. But history again shows us that year after year, without taking those hard decisions, things are rarely better. They're generally worse. Coupled to the predominance of social and economic goals, we see superimposed on that a tendency in our 20th, 21st century world that the interests of large-term economic groups or large-term economic concerns take precedence. And this has exacerbated the social impacts of fisheries. So we see, and again you see it here, coastal communities that are losing their identity, losing their employment, losing their options as we move more and more into this massive, large-scale, factory-type production in fisheries, in agriculture, in everything we do. Then the third point in fisheries, which is linked to all the others, is we so often find we have poorly defined and conflicting objectives. We don't actually very often plan what we want in fisheries. We simply react to the crises. So we let it run, and we see how it runs, and if nobody complains, we let it run another year. If somebody complains, we say, well, how can we keep that complaint quiet? And we make short-term decisions. We don't work out where we want to go, where we want to be in 20 years' time, resolve the conflicts within those plans, and move forward on that. And I'll give you an example of that later on. And then on a more specialized but equally important level, we've discovered in the last 100 years or so the institutional weaknesses. And there are two primary ones there. The first is that, interestingly, but I haven't got time to go into it, but to a large extent under the influence of colonial expansion, the seas became seen as being public property, owned by no one. And that led to a whole feeling of open access, which included the coastal fisheries, included the coastal areas. So the seas and everything in the seas were seen as being everybody's property. In some ways, this seems like a nice idea, an open and a just system. But unfortunately, the result of this with natural resources, limited natural resources, is that inevitably they will become overexploited as more and more people move in to take opportunity of the resources that are there. With proper controls, one can have an open access system that isn't biologically exploited, but it requires tight control. But even with those, it will inevitably be economically, socially, and in many other respects, highly inefficient. And we have seen those, and most often, because there haven't been the proper controls, we've seen those accompanied by biological overexploitation in our fisheries. We have woken up to that recently within the last 30 years perhaps, and we're starting to implement limited access. But that's a difficult thing to do. When you implement limited access, you're having to say to some people who may have been earning their living there all their lives, sorry, no longer, and to others, yes, you can continue fishing there. Ethically, politically, it is a difficult thing, but it's something we have to do and we have to find the right solutions. It's happening. It's happening slowly. And then finally, again, in the 20th century, we seem to find ourselves in fisheries with very bureaucratically managed fisheries. Scientists and governments took control of the fisheries. Scientists and governments would tell the fishers what to do in their own best interests. And we found that fishers didn't always agree with the scientists and the governments, and they would do their own thing anyway, and probably rightly in some cases. They certainly should have been consulted. Again, fortunately, we've learned that, and we're moving into trying to get the users more involved, trying to get cooperative systems where the scientists, the government agencies, the fishers work in partnership. We've got a long way to go. We're making progress in those areas. Those are the major problems. Now, science clearly can play a role in all of those. It stands out, obviously, in the first, ecological uncertainty, but in fact, it has a role in all of them. And that I want to talk about. But let's first of all say, what is science? And that might seem like a very academic question, but I think it's a topical question. If I look at where I always look when I don't understand words, a dictionary, we come up with the definition from the Oxford Dictionary, a branch of knowledge involving the systematized observation of and experiment with phenomena. That actually doesn't help me very much. It's the word systematized is quite useful, but that could be lots of other things that I wouldn't consider science. I won't hazard a guess at some of them right at the moment. But if we go on to the Encyclopedia Britannica, which is always my second resort if the dictionary doesn't help me, I think we find a more useful description. And this particular description or expanded definition suggests, first of all, that it's related to the physical world. And by the physical world, they don't mean physics as opposed to chemistry, but physics as opposed to metaphysics. Physics, everything that is physical, everything we can touch, everything tangible. Actually, now I'm getting myself in knots. Let's go back to the Encyclopedia Britannica. They know what they're talking about. So we're dealing with the physical world. Then the second important point here is we're talking about unbiased explanations of the physical world. And this is something I will be coming on to later. What science is aiming for, and this is where we get down to its rule, it is aiming for general truths and an explanation of fundamental laws. And that is what in so many areas in the 21st century we look to science for. We want to know those fundamental laws, and we want to know them so they help us to decide what to do next. They help us to make decisions. And that is the role of science in fisheries, just as it is in so many other areas. But that determining the truth, how do we determine the truth? At one level, that seems fairly easy. We all know what the truth is. But 400 years, my arithmetic's as weak as my grammar, years ago, people also were confident they knew the truth. And they knew the scientific truth. But then along came a few people, perhaps the best known of whom was Galileo. And he said, but hold it, your idea of the truth doesn't match with my observations. Here, I've been taught all along that the sun rotates around the earth. But if I look at Copernicus and I look at various other things, that's not the way I see the truth. The truth, to me, seems to be that the earth rotates around the sun. He wasn't very popular for a while, but gradually we became to realize that inasmuch as we can say it about anything, that seems to be the truth. So the truth changed. And when I thought of that, I asked the question, I wonder how people in 300 years' time are going to look back at our understanding of scientific truths now. How much of these theories that we think we have confidently pinned down will in fact still be up there and still be considered the truth. So it's not that easy to determine the truth. So again, looking to some philosophers, I had a look at how do we decide whether we are determining the truth or not. And Immanuel Kant came up with an indication, which actually when I looked at it, I thought was about as useful as the Oxford Dictionary. If something is valid for anybody in possession of his reason, then its grounds are objective and sufficient. Again, that seems good. And obviously it's correct. What he's saying is if it makes sense, if all rational people accept it, then the chances are it's the truth. But we go back to the Galileo example. We can be misled. In all honesty, with all the knowledge, we can be misled. In the 20th century, we had one of the top philosophers, certainly of the 20th century, Karl Popper, an Austrian gentleman who then moved on to Britain. And he did a lot of work in the philosophy of science, and his understanding of science now, I think, really dominates current scientific thinking. And one of Popper's statements was, or one of Popper's suggestions was, that the objectivity of science, the unbiasedness of science, lies in the fact that it can be tested by anyone. It can be intersubjectively tested. And that, we say today, is now a fundamental property of science, that any statements and any conclusions that are made as science can be tested. The methods can be replicated, and if you do exactly the same thing again, you should come up with the same answer. They can be intersubjectively tested. But that also leads to a very important conclusion, because if any statement, in order to be scientific, can be tested, then that means at any time it can be disproved. If it's got to be open to testing, then there's always a chance that the next test is going to show it's wrong. And that means we never prove anything in science. And this is one of Popper's big statements, and I think it's a very profound statement. In science, we don't come up with proofs. We simply gain more confidence in what we believe if a scientific statement passes a test. So in science, we don't try and prove things, we try and disprove things. And if we fail to disprove something, then we can have more confidence that it's correct. So we corroborate what we know. And I think that's a very important aspect of science, and a very important aspect for users of science to understand. We put forward the best we know now, but tomorrow we might change our minds because we might have learned something new. It makes it harder, but it's the reality. So then, with that in mind, what do we look to science for in fisheries management or in resource management in general? And I would suggest that we're using science in fisheries to help us to make good decisions. And what it does is it tries to give the best information on the current state of the fishery. That's the resources, the fish themselves or the shellfish, whatever resources we're talking about, their current status, the current status of the fishes and everything related to the fishes, the economics of the fishes, their social life, everything we're concerned about in managing the fishery. Science can help us to understand that and say what's happening now. And from that, we can use science to say what will happen tomorrow or next year if we take certain steps or if we don't take certain steps. And that is the role of science in fisheries management, to help us to make good decisions so we achieve our objectives, so those fisheries deliver what we want them to deliver, whatever that might be, and it will be different in one fishery to another. So that is the role of science. But we come back to the problem of how good can it be? How much can we rely on that science? And you remember in, I think it was the Encyclopedia Britannica decision, it referred to unbiased observation. And this is one of the limitations of science, is how far can we go in lack of bias? And I can see you all looking at that picture thinking, what is he doing now? Got the wrong slides. No, actually, that is the right slide. And why I'd like you to look at that picture, that painting. And that painting was made by an early Renaissance Italian painter, Sandro Botticelli. And the Renaissance painters, at least in Italy, their task was to paint religious scenes. So they were painting reality as they understood it for their audience, for their clients. So this is, in Botticelli's eyes, a picture of reality. And this is the Madonna of the Magnificat. And it's showing, as those of you from a Christian background will probably recognize it, showing Mary and the Christ child. And Botticelli was putting that forward as a real scene. But if you look at that, it doesn't take much to see there's something wrong there. If you look at those people, they certainly don't look like the sort of people I would imagine living in Palestine 2,000 years ago. I look at those people and I see 15th century Italian aristocrats. And if you look beyond the people and look at that little glimpse of scenery we get in the background, I don't see the arid Middle East. I see the Tuscan countryside around Florence. There is Botticelli's portrayal of reality. And there is some, from the Christian tradition, there's some reality in there. There's a lot of reality in there, but there's a lot of Botticelli in there as well. And why I show that painting is because in science, we have the same problem. The whole method of science is designed to reduce the problem, but it still creeps through. And in science, we still get reality and the personality of the scientist confused and mixed up. And if we're going to use science for making important decisions, we have to be able to disentangle the two and say, all right, that bit's Kevin Cochrane, chuck it out. No, I think this bit's reality, let's use that. And that's one of the problems we have to face in science. That's not a new statement. That was this bias of science was discussed in some detail by a philosopher, and needless to say, a lawyer. He knew all about human nature. Francis Blake, and he was a member of the Elizabethan court. And he identified, he also, incidentally, is regarded by many as the founder of modern science. And he put great emphasis on unbiased observation. But he said, we are all fundamentally biased. And he identified four different biases that he said all people have. And he called these idols. And the four idols were the idols of the tribe, which are our cultural prejudices and our cultural biases. The idols of the marketplace, which is an interesting one. And these are the beliefs that we carry with us in our language without even realizing it. We use words and they mean something to us and we accept that intuitively. One of those, I was trying to think of good ones, one that a student actually put forward was equilibrium. We talk about equilibrium in ecological systems or in science as if it's something that's really there. It's something that systems strive for. Is it, or is it just we would like things to be in equilibrium, and therefore we try and impose that equilibrium on them? Then there are the idols of the cave, which are the biases and prejudices unique to each one of us, our likes, our dislikes, our fears, etc. And the idols of the theater. These are the most difficult ones because these are the methods and the assumptions we carry with us. As ecologists, we have at this time, we have particular beliefs, particular schools of thought that we assume are the best. These, again, are going to show up biases and problems. If you put those all together, we're introducing some profound uncertainties into science that we need to be aware of when we're using science for making uncertain, for making difficult decisions. But we have to go beyond that. And even if we can iron all of those out, and that is what science does attempt to do, it does attempt to reduce bias, but even if we can reduce all that, we find in any complex system there are uncertainties. There are things we just don't know and things we cannot know. Again, that is something that the public, I think, don't like to hear. They don't like to hear that science can't provide them with the answers they want. But the reality is it can't. And two fisheries scientists, Chris Francis and Ross Shotton, have classified the uncertainties, the unavoidable uncertainties in fisheries in particular, into six types. And I'll just go through those briefly because I think it's quite interesting to know. The first is process uncertainty. And that is the uncertainty that is inherent to the system. It's nothing to do with our observation. It might be something to do with our lack of understanding. But it's the random variability, or at least what we understand as the random variability in a system. In fisheries, we see this most obviously in the recruitment, the spawning from year to year, which can change dramatically, double, treble from one year to the next, and we don't know why. We just know next year it's going to be different. It might be higher, it might be lower. We simply don't know why, and in most cases, we can't even begin to predict why. That's one example of process uncertainty. Observation uncertainty is the error that comes into our attempts to measure things. The measurements themselves, when we measure the length of a fish, we don't measure it entirely accurately. We might get it to within 1%, we might get it to within 0.1%. There's always some error. When we measure 100 fish, there's more error. When we try and measure 100 fish and use that to understand the length of 3 million fish, we get into measurement error. We can reduce those to some extent by putting more and more sampling, more and more sophisticated equipment, but certainly in fisheries, for the foreseeable future, there will be a lot of unexplained observation uncertainty. Then there's model uncertainty. Again, in fisheries and in most systems, we make models. We're dealing with very complex systems. We can't understand them fully, so we simplify them. We simplify them into our best understanding of how they work, and that we call a model. That model doesn't capture everything about the system. No matter how hard we try, it doesn't. It still leaves uncertainty. Those we call the model uncertainties. Then when we put all those three together and we try to make estimations, for example, we try to estimate how many fish are there this year, or we try to estimate how many fish will there be next year if we catch 1,000 tons, we get into estimation uncertainty. Our estimates, because of the previous three, are always going to be uncertain. Sometimes they're only a little bit uncertain. Sometimes they have a lot of unexplained uncertainty around them. Now we throw in the people, and whenever you throw in the people, things get more complicated. We get institutional uncertainty. And institutional uncertainty, in this context, we're talking about making decisions. Let's say we give perfect scientific advice. We give it to a group of people and say, make your decision on how to manage the fishery. We're going to run into institutional uncertainty. The people are going to disagree. They're going to misunderstand each other. They're going to have their own objectives, which they don't actually tell everybody else, but they just try and play the game to achieve their objectives. All of these lead to us making imperfect decisions. Even when we have good information, we manage to mess it up and make bad decisions. If we do it really well, we manage to mess it up and just make not such good decisions, but all too often we mess it up and make bad decisions. And then finally, we come into implementation uncertainty. Let's say we make a good decision and we say, all right, we're going to manage the fishery by taking 1,000 tons between July and August next year. We run into the implementation uncertainty. Some people are going to say that's not enough, or I'm not going to stop it at 1,000 tons. I need more to pay off my new boat, or I've got a big debt. And we will find that very rarely are our decisions implemented perfectly. Usually, we overrun, we overshoot, we make mistakes there. If you add those all together, you start to get a good picture of what's happening in fisheries. And I'd like to try and show that with two examples. I would have actually have liked to show three examples, because the third one, which deals with CITES, the Convention for International Trade in Endangered Species, is a particularly interesting one as well. But it is Saturday evening, and I was told people like to go home before Sunday, so I cut it down to two. And the first one I would like to show you and talk about is an example in which I was directly involved, and that is the South African pelagic fishery. That's fishing for sardine and anchovy. The second one, which we'll come on to after that, I wasn't involved in at all, not even second hand, but it's an international issue, and it's an extreme in many ways. So I thought that would be an interesting one to look at as well. But let's start with the South African. And the South African pelagic fishery is a very important fishery to South Africa. It's the second most economically important. Its value typically each year is about $80 million, which perhaps by Canadian fishery standards is not a huge amount. But locally in the region, it's a very important contribution to the economy. About 5,000 people are employed in the pelagic fishery. And of those 5,000, quite a large number would only be seasonally employed. They would only be employed while the fish were being caught, and they would be employed in the factories. So the longer, the bigger the TAC, the more fish that were caught, the longer their employment, the more money they would earn. And for many of these people, South Africa is a developing country, for many of these people, the seasonal employment was in fact their only income for the year. So with $80 million and 5,000 people, some of whom were really heavily dependent on this fishery for their livelihood, one had to make careful decisions. You knew any decision to increase or decrease the total allowable catch had significant implications. Now, this fishery has two parts, as I show in this diagram. The one is the anchovy fishery, which, as its name suggests, fishes mainly for anchovy. And those anchovy are used to make fish meal and fish oil. In catching the anchovy, though, they also catch juvenile pilchard, the little fish shown at the bottom, because the juvenile pilchard shoal with the anchovy. So the main catch is anchovy, but also some juvenile pilchard. The other fishery is the pilchard fishery, which catches adult pilchard, and these are used for human consumption. Now, these two fisheries, therefore, are in conflict, because the more anchovy you catch, the more juvenile pilchard you catch. The more juvenile pilchard you catch, the fewer are going to grow up into adults, so the fewer pilchard you can catch. So you have a conflict here. You can't aim to maximize the catch from the anchovy at the same time as you're aiming to maximize the catch from the pilchard. So that introduces a conflict, which makes it more difficult and more interesting. Let's just have a look at the history of the fishery for, 20 years, 15 years, something like that, in this diagram. In the early 60s and going into the 70s, sardine was dominant, and catches of sardine went up to about 400,000 tons. But then, as so often happens, a combination of overfishing and an adverse environment, the sardine collapsed down to the very low levels. You can see there the dotted line in 1984, under 100,000 tons of sardine in total. However, when the sardine went down, the anchovy appeared to come up, and the anchovy got to biomasses of up to about 2 million tons. So the fishery at that point switched from pilchard or sardine and went on to anchovy. And anchovy was the dominant fishery throughout much of the 80s and 90s at the period when I was working on it. So the fisheries themselves focused on anchovy, but also were trying to get pilchard, obviously, to increase their profitability, increase their returns. Now, despite the conflict in these two fisheries, the people involved in them were the same people, and they managed to agree on the objectives. And the objectives they set for the two fisheries combined was they wanted to keep the biomasses at biologically safe levels. They wanted to manage these as sustainable fisheries. In addition, for employment reasons, for ease of marketing, all sorts of things, they wanted to try and keep some stability. So they wanted to try and keep the TAC, the total allowable catch, as constant as possible in each of the two from year to year. They also wanted to see the pilchard come up. The pilchard, 1 ton of pilchard is worth 6 times 1 ton of anchovy. So they would like to have seen it returning to the 1960-1970 situation where there wasn't much anchovy but there was a lot of pilchard. So they also wanted to allow for the growth of pilchard while at the same time fishing for it. Is that the warning buzzer? Putting these together, they wanted to get the maximum average catch, obviously, but without jeopardizing those objectives 1, 2, and 3. And in order to do that, they realized they had to give up some of their pilchard as what we call bycatch, as the catch of pilchard with the anchovy. So those were their objectives. And we tried to work with them to see, well, how can we actually get a management system that it best achieves those objectives? And we used science to try and do that. Now, in many ways, this was a very easy fishery to work with. And I mention that because when we get onto the problems, we need to remember that this fishery had many advantages. And the advantages were that it was essentially a clean fishery. Apart from this one little bycatch hook of catching juvenile pilchard, it caught those two species. So it was fairly easy to manage. There were only five major companies. Five companies held 80% of the quota. So if we could get the agreement of five companies, if they bought into this, then we had a pretty good chance of things working. In addition, those five companies all had largely similar philosophies, or so it seemed to us. They were all commercial. Their profit was their primary interest. Well, obviously, in that, they had a staff to look after. They were all diversified. They had other interests, so they weren't totally dependent on this fishery. So they were easy groups to work with in many respects. In addition, we had very good underlying science. A lot of money and effort had been put into studying anchovy and pilchard. We knew a lot about its biology. Every year, two hydroacoustic surveys went out and measured the biomass of the surveys. So with observation error, with sampling error, we still had fairly good estimates of the biomass. We had a lot of good science there. And over the years, fairly good trust had been built up between the managers, the scientists, and the fishers. So we were starting from a really good point in building up a good system that would achieve those objectives. We had some uncertainties, though. We were talking about a real fishery. So we had good science. In many ways, we had as good a science as you could find anywhere in the world, but we knew there were things we didn't know well. And probably you could take those same points, four bullets, and they would apply to just about any fishery going. But specifically in the case of these pelagic fisheries, they were highly variable. As you might have noticed with the anchovy, it changed quite a lot from year to year, and we had no way of knowing what next year's recruitment would be. So we had to look at averages, and we had to look at average variability in making any forecast. We had estimates of their natural survival rates, but we knew they were poor estimates. It's a very difficult thing to measure. So we didn't know, in fact, if they were left alone, how many of them normally would survive from 1 year to the next. We didn't know how low you could let the spawner biomass, the adults, go before you would start noticing lower recruitment. So we didn't know how low we could allow them to fish it before we would really run into problems. So arising out of those three, we couldn't really define with any degree of confidence what was an acceptable risk. What we said, we set a reference point and we said, well, we really don't want the biomass to go below 20% of its pristine, 20% of what would be there in an unfished system. And this is a common reference point in fisheries. So we said, that's the level we don't want to go below. But now we had to decide, if we did go below, how serious was it? If we went below that 1 year out of 50, is that a concern? If we went below it 5 years out of 50, is that a concern? If we went below 10 years out of 50, would we start running into trouble? And we had no real way of answering that. And when you get down to it, that is one of the fundamental problems when we're looking at sustainability of fisheries, is we don't know those risks at low levels. Now, the one easy response to that is say, all right, well, if you don't know those risks, then be very, very cautious. And of course, that's biologically, that is what one tries to do. But when you're looking at social and economic aims as well, you don't want to be too cautious. So this is our big Achilles heel in this fishery and in other fisheries. But nevertheless, the industry knew this, we knew this, and we started working with them. And we started producing science, and we started producing results like this. And what this shows is the bycatch percentage. That is the percent of pilchard, juvenile pilchard, in the anchovy TAC. If we allowed a 3% bycatch of pilchard, that means 3% of their anchovy catch was in fact pilchard. We would then have a look at, well, how would the pilchard perform? And we estimated that if on average they took 3% of the anchovy catch as bycatch, they would require 19, this obviously we knew what we were expecting from the anchovy fishery, so we fed that into this model. They would then take on average about 20,000 tons of juvenile pilchard each year. Allowing that to feed through into the system, that would mean they could take about 44,000 tons of directed pilchard per year. That would go into cans for human consumption. With those figures, there would be 0% chance of the pilchard falling below that 20% level. And we would expect to see after 20... that 3% bycatch just seemed far too low. And the industry said, we can't live with 3%. If we tried to attain 3%, we would have to cut right back on our anchovy fishery to a point where it's not viable. So can't we go higher? So then we look at 6%. If you double the percentage, then it actually, for various reasons, it comes out to 29,000 tons of juvenile pilchard. That gives a reduced pilchard directed catch because fewer are maturing, but they could still get just under 40,000 tons of pilchard. The risk now goes up slightly, 3% risk. There's a 3% chance of it falling below that 20% level. Still not too bad, and it would still grow. We would still expect it to grow by 31%. But even that was too low, because they were saying, look, in the last few years, we've been getting bycatch percentages of 15 or 20%. You're now trying to cut that down by less than half. But when we looked at 9%, that became impossible, because then you would be looking at a 35% risk of falling below 20%, and you would be looking at zero expected growth. They realized, they looked at that, and they also said, well, yeah, this is a problem. And eventually we agreed on 6%. They agreed reluctantly, but they couldn't see an alternative. So that was what we agreed on, and in 1994 we put in this policy where we had separate decision rules for anchovy, and we had these decision rules for sardine, and one of the important rules was 6% bycatch. And this is what happened when we put it into play. We implemented it in 1994. Now you can see before 1994, there had been problems with bycatch, or there had been problems with exceeding the catch. And the directed catch had gone above the recommendations in the previous 2 years, 1992 and 1993. Up until that point, there was no bycatch TAC set, so they could catch as much bycatch as they had to, although they did voluntarily try and eliminate that. And they were getting bycatch percentages of 15 to 20%. We implemented the 6% limit in 1994. That gave us a bycatch recommendation of 21,000 tons. About halfway through the season, they started complaining and saying, we can't go on like this. We need more bycatch. They lobbied the government gave in, and the government allowed them to take more bycatch. They ended up taking 45,000 tons of bycatch instead of 21,000 tons. It broke down before we had even started. The following year, the situation in some ways got worse, not from a bycatch point of view, but as I'll show you in a graph, in the next graph, anchovy went down so low that the bycatches went up to 50% and we shut down the anchovy fishery, but they still deviated from the rules with the directed catch and exceeded the directed catch. So despite all the advantages, despite all the hard work, despite the trust and genuinely good faith on behalf of the industry, it didn't work. It broke down. It was probably better than it wouldn't have been if we hadn't done all this work, but still we weren't getting what we were hoping for, and we wouldn't attain the objectives we were hoping for. Now, why did it break down? We thought afterwards, when we looked at this, we came down to four reasons. First of all, conflict between socio-economic and conservation priorities. At the end of the day, even though they wanted to achieve those biological objectives, when it came to the crunch, they had to meet their shareholders' expectations, they had to pay their employees, they had to meet all these social and economic obligations, and they said, as I mentioned a while ago, leave it this year, next year maybe will be better. Let's take more now. Secondly, there were different priorities amongst the groups, which we only discovered later. In fact, some of the groups weren't that interested in pilchard. They put all their emphasis on anchovy. And so when it came to the crunch, they weren't prepared to sacrifice anchovy for the sake of the pilchard fishery. And we hadn't picked that up at the beginning. We only realized that afterwards when they were the ones that really pushed hard on the anchovy. Because of this, we actually hadn't really achieved agreement on the objectives. We thought we had, but we hadn't. Those who wanted the anchovy had agreed, they'd probably genuinely agreed, but at the back of their minds they knew, in fact, this wasn't really what they wanted. And then there was the uncertainty, and this was really a big one, we felt. And there were two forms of uncertainty. The first was the scientific uncertainty, because they knew about our science. There were engineers working for the industry, there were scientists, not natural scientists, but scientists. They knew we were doing the best work we could do with the results, but they also knew the uncertainties. And they knew that the sacrifices they made this year might not pay them back next year, because in fact the environment could change and there might be less next year. And then there was an additional uncertainty at that time, because this was in the mid-90s when South Africa was going through its transition from an apartheid era to a democratic era. These were white-owned companies that had been fishing for 20 years, and they didn't know how the new ANC government was going to view them. So they didn't know whether next year they would still have rights to the fishery, or the year after they would still have rights to the fishery. So again, they didn't know whether the sacrifices they made this year would in fact pay returns next year. So in the end, what they decided was, we're not going to take a chance. Give it to us now. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And I think this is again, a very understandable and a very common philosophy, but of course it's a short-sighted philosophy. I'll skip through that one. Just what happened next? Interesting question. 1996, as I said, things got worse. The anchovy went down. Pilchard stayed roughly the same. It looked as if we should just shut down the anchovy and manage it on a pilchard fishery. It would have made it a whole lot easier. Thereafter, the world turned around. And we got record recruitment in anchovy. Anchovy reached record levels, over 4 million tons. I would never have believed that when I was there. And pilchard continued to grow. The industry were happy. They still are happy. If we had known that was coming, could we have done anything differently? I actually don't think so, not in any fundamental way. Those unknowns were still there. I think what we did learn from this is the important issue is to get down to those objectives and to actually challenge those objectives and make sure everybody's speaking the same language and make sure everybody's genuinely working to the same goals. And maybe that means taking big decisions outside the fishery. Maybe it means closing down fisheries. But it's no good pretending and it's no good working on half-formed plans. I've gone on much too long on that one, so I'm going to have to really race through Southern Bluefin Tuna. Tony, I need one of those sherries you told me doubles the speed of one speech. This is the Southern Bluefin Tuna, which is well known in fishery circles as being a really interesting fishy story. The Southern Bluefin Tuna occurs in that blue band. It occurs in the Southern Hemisphere. It breeds, it spawns, and matures around Southeast Asia and Australia, and then spreads out along that sort of narrow band in the southern latitudes. It's an incredibly valuable fishery. It's highly prized on the Japanese market, and high-quality fish can sell for $1,000 per kilo. That means a 90-kilogram fish, which is not unusual, can sell for $90,000. It started in the 1950s, and the common story with fisheries catches rose very rapidly to 80,000 tons. We'd overexploited the resource. It started to come down. Under some sort of management, it stabilized in the 1990s. It's been managed by a group called the Commission for the Conservation of Southern Bluefin Tuna since 1994. That commission was formed by three countries, Australia, Japan, and New Zealand. When they saw these catches going down, Japan in particular saw its fishing rates decreasing fairly rapidly, and they decided they needed to take urgent action. So they got together, and in terms of the law of the sea, they formed this commission. There are other nations fishing for bluefin tuna who are not members of the commission, the main ones being Indonesia, Korea, and Taiwan. Korea is currently in the process of joining the commission. The commission took a very strong conservation and scientific viewpoint from the beginning, and from the beginning it formed a scientific committee made up of scientists from those three countries to advise it. They decided, when they saw what was happening, that they had to set a goal, and they decided that their goal must be to rebuild the stock to the level it was in 1980, which they thought was a viable, productive stock. And to also allow for the social and economic goals, they decided to do that gradually and to rebuild it by 2020. That's still their goal, and they do this mainly by setting a total allowable catch and by restricting fish in the spawning grounds. A very responsible approach from the beginning. So in 1985, before the commission, those three countries had already started to bring the total allowable catch down to about under 40,000 tons. By 1989, with Japan reporting these decreasing catch rates, it had come down to just under 12,000 tons. It was all being managed well, but then things started to get complicated. In the 1990s, Japan began to report an increase in its catch rate, which they interpreted as an increase in biomass. So they said, let's increase the TAC. The other two countries, Australia and New Zealand, said no. We're not sure about that rate. We're not confident. Let's keep it constant. They argued about this. Japan agreed to keep the TAC constant at just under 12,000 tons, but Japan wasn't happy. In the mid-1990s, Japan proposed an experimental fishery program to try and get a better estimate of what was happening in the biomass. And I'll come back to that in a minute because that's key in this debate. They agreed that such an experimental fishery was important, but they couldn't agree on how they should do it. They couldn't agree on the design and the implementation of that experimental fishery. So they talked round and round in circles about it, but without making a decision. At the same time, they kept the TAC constant. By 1997, Japan had got fed up with this. And Japan said, no, we are not agreeing to a TAC of 11,750 tons. The commission had made the decision at the beginning. They would make decisions by consensus. They couldn't reach consensus, so they didn't make a decision. But no TAC was set that year. But each of those three countries decided they would keep their catches at a constant rate. Japan continued pushing for this experimental fishing program, again with no progress. So in 1998, Japan got thoroughly fed up and said, we're doing it on our own. We're going to start an experimental fishery program. We're going to require an additional 2,000 tons to launch that program. Australia and New Zealand didn't like this. And Australia and New Zealand immediately took action. The first thing they did was they closed their ports to Japanese fishing vessels and said they will remain closed until we can agree on a TAC. They also went to the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, and they applied to that international tribunal for a temporary injunction to stop fishing. That was the first time this has ever happened in fisheries matters, which makes it highly significant. So after a good start, things had suddenly run into a logjam. And underneath that, the basic cause of that was disagreement about science, was scientific uncertainties. And that's shown in this 1996 result, where the three countries were putting forward their projection of how likely that stock recovery by 2020 was, judging by at current catch levels. Australia and New Zealand were pessimistic. They were giving forecasts of 15% and 29% respectively. But Japan, influenced by their increasing catch rates, estimated that, all of them were using scientific methods, estimated the recovery at 79% probability. So they were far more optimistic. All using science. Interestingly, some external scientists brought in, their forecast was somewhat closer to the Japanese. Now, underlying this was a huge amount of scientific uncertainty. I am getting towards the end, by the way. was a huge amount of unscientific uncertainty and disagreement. And they were disagreeing on all these points and some more that I couldn't fit on this slide. One of the Australian scientists, Tom Polacek, who was one of the big modeling people, he estimated that they would need 1,600 different variations of the model they were using to include all the different options for those uncertainties. And they would then need to run all of those 1,600 models to see what the range of possible solutions was. And this is a big, complicated model. Even with today's computing power, to run those 1,600 possible options was simply out of the question. So there was all this scientific confusion and scientific disagreement. The two key ones were the first two. If I go to the second one, that method of estimating the plus group, that's quite a complicated thing, and having read the documents, I must admit I don't know all the ins and outs. So we won't go into that. That's concerned with dealing with all the old fish that one lumps together in one group in an age-structured model. And there were lots of disagreements about how you should handle that. But the first one is the very important one, because that is what underlay this experimental fishing program, is that they couldn't agree on what the catch rate data was telling them about the abundance. And one of the key things there was that in the 1980s, when they decided to reduce fishing, they also reduced the area in which they were fishing. So all the fishing vessels moved into a much smaller area. So they still had good information on what was happening in the small area, how the catches were going up and down each year, but they knew nothing about what was happening in the wider area. So they couldn't estimate the full abundance. And they had to make assumptions about what was happening in that previously unfished area. And they made two different assumptions. The one assumption, which they called in a very scientific term, the variable squares assumption, they assumed that there were no fish in those areas that used to be fished. That simply disappeared as the population went down. The Australians and the New Zealanders favored that assumption. The Japanese favored what was called a constant squares assumption. And that constant squares assumption was that the density of fish in those unfished areas would have remained the same as it was when they stopped fishing in the 1980s. And they could not reach a compromise on those two different assumptions. And those, coupled with other scientific uncertainties, were preventing them moving forward. And the commission itself, made up more of politicians, diplomats, managers, were being guided by their national scientific delegations. The Japanese wanted this experimental fishing program to go beyond the boundaries and to look in those areas to see what the densities were, but they couldn't reach agreement on how to do that. So that was scientific uncertainty, scientific disagreement, driving the whole thing. How did they solve it? Well, the short answer is they haven't solved it. And as far as I know, the latest information I could find was October 2001, and they hadn't reached agreement on a TAC again. But they are making good progress. And the way they've made that good progress, or the way they've made the progress, is largely by bringing in independent scientists. It started in 1994, but those early scientists could just really play an observing role and just comment on some technical detail. But in 1998, when things were starting to get really controversial, they brought in an independent review to look at the whole scientific process. And interestingly, one of the things that that review suggested was that cultural issues were playing a difference. Australia and New Zealand were tending to side together because of their cultural commonality and similarity. And because there were only three parties, that left Japan feeling isolated and threatened. And so the scientists, instead of trying to come together, were polarized and disagreeing. And that commission said, or so that panel said, if the commission had been bigger, if there had been a larger number of parties and hence less chance of polarization, there would probably have been less of a conflict. Anyway, moving very quickly, they've now moved more and more into that. They got a scientific advisory group in 1999 to really try and oversee the whole thing of independent scientists from countries outside the region. Interestingly, when that scientific advisory committee group got together, one of the first things they did was they said neither of those two catch rate assumptions are likely to be correct. And they went for a middle one. And they said the best assumption to start with is to say that the catch rates in those other squares have fluctuated in the same proportions as the catch rates in the squares that are being fished. And that's now the working hypothesis. They had to resolve it because the International Tribunal, which had actually supported Australia, in that went to an arbitral tribunal, and in 2000 they threw it right back at the Commission and said, according to the rules of the Commission, you have to resolve this yourselves. So it's back to you, leave us alone. So they have to resolve it themselves. They are making progress at present. As I understand it, the scientific advisory group are working fairly cooperatively with the scientific committee, and they're getting the details of that experimental fishery program worked out, and they're working towards a TAC. So I think at the moment they are optimistic they will have a TAC for 2002. You will be pleased to hear this is the first of two concluding slides. Okay, so where do we go from here? How do we build up on this? If what I've said has left you with a feeling that I'm opposing science or I'm in any way antagonistic to science, I've failed in what I've said. We have to have good, unbiased, objective science in guiding us in our decisions. We cannot manage our natural systems, we cannot manage most of our human systems without unbiased science. However, we have to realize that getting that good unbiased science is not easy. We have to put real effort into it. We have to promote it. We have to work hard for it. Peer review, independent review, where we're making difficult or controversial decisions, will become extremely important. Even with that, there will be uncertainties. Science cannot provide us with all the answers. It cannot provide us with a crutch that prevents us having to make difficult decisions. So what can we do? Science cannot generate policy. Policy has to be made in open, transparent decisions. Policy concerns things like human values, human priorities, human willingness to take risks. Science cannot make those decisions for us. We have to leave those to ourselves or to those we designate as our decision makers. In doing this, I think scientists have to make a greater effort to bring this reality to the attention of the public, to the attention of decision makers. As scientists, we like a feeling of power. We like to feel we can come in and influence a debate. We mustn't push that further than is real. So we have to bring in those uncertainties. Overall, science can provide a compass that can help us to maintain a course, But science cannot decide for us what that course should be. And I think that is the overriding message I would like to close with. Thank you, and thank you all for your patience.
Just a few minutes for questions.
Yes.
Just to repeat the question, how in South Africa did we communicate the uncertainties to the users? And that is a very important question. Science is very often difficult to understand for non-scientists. And when one starts working with small communities, with perhaps people who have been fishermen all their lives and haven't benefited from advanced education, it is extremely difficult. And this was certainly one of the problems we had. As I mentioned, we were fortunate there in that there was a good sprinkling of people who were easily able to understand what we were saying. And they could very often take it back to their decision makers. They could translate it to their own people in ways they could understand. One doesn't always have that. We used a lot of techniques. We actually developed a computer game where we enabled them to make the decisions in uncertain environments and see the consequences time and time again. We gave them presentations. We had endless meetings where we tried to explain our models to us. We were partially successful. There's one example I remember well where there was an elderly man, a very senior and respected fisherman, and we worked very hard with him. And I was sitting down in this computer game, and I explained to him several times, as carefully as I could, that this was a random simulation. It wasn't meant to be the real thing. And I thought he understood it, and we started playing the game, and the first few points, they showed the biomass of the stock from year to year, and each time you had to make a decision on how much catch to allow. And the trajectory that followed, the biomasses that came out for the first 3 or 4 years, by coincidence, followed the early history of the fishery. And he picked this up, and he said, "You know, you people have got it. This is just what actually happened." He hadn't understood what I was saying at all, and that was a very sobering moment for me, and I realized we had a lot of work to do. It is a real problem. Scientists are not very good at doing it. We've got to work harder at it, and we've got to do it in the context that people are used to. I would say they were a mixture. There were certainly some educated, risk-averse members. There were some educated, there were some educated, risk-averse. There were some who were more risk-prone. I think they were also more risk-prone because of the political uncertainty I mentioned. I would say they were educated, risk average for fishermen or fishing industry. But what your point is a very important one. We have to work very hard at conveying science. Oh, sorry. Right. That's a very difficult question. Thank you for reminding. The question was, is there some sort of vacuum here? Let's say we have the science there, but very often the right decisions, are simply not being made for various reasons. Is there a need for some, I can't remember the exact phrase, but some sort of overarching pressure to try and force these correct decisions to be made? Have I paraphrased that reasonably? Right. Yeah. It's been very interesting for me to work within a large intergovernmental system. And one thing you see very quickly, which you would have seen at all, is as soon as any organization tries to stand on national toes, those national toes get very uncomfortable and back off very quickly. As soon as an international organization tries to tell a country what to do, the country says, back off, it's none of your business. The whole UN law of the sea was about extending national jurisdiction to 200 miles so countries could do what they wanted within the 200 miles. So at the one level, it's very difficult. But on another level, there is, and it's imperfect and it's slow, but there is a growing international agreement that we need these sort of regimes. So for example, in 1995, within FAO fisheries, the countries developed and agreed on a code of conduct for responsible fisheries. It's a voluntary code, but all the countries agreed that they would try and implement that code. So simply by doing that, they have said, if we don't, we're opening ourselves to criticism. And they are making some progress. There's, in 1995, they agreed to the UN Fish Stocks Agreement, which deals with international waters, but is pressuring them into forming bodies like the Commission for the Conservation of Southern Bluefin Tuna, wherever there are international fisheries or multinational fisheries, fishing. They've developed recently four international plans of action covering sharks, fishing capacity, seabirds, and illegal, unregulated, unreported fishing. Again, voluntary agreements, but they're building up themselves, building up the pressure. Some of these will slowly start to become international law. There's a long way between formulating a law and actually achieving it. I think it's happening. It needs to be driven more. How one does it, I don't know. Right. The question was one I'd rather not have to repeat in my position. What do I think about the expansion of aquaculture on the British Columbia coast, a decision just made recently? To be quite honest, even if I knew details and had an answer, as an FAO employee, I wouldn't make that reply to that in a forum like this. I couldn't. However, I can make so. I don't know much about it. But what I can say, and will happily say, is that that aquaculture was seen as a panacea 20 years ago. And it certainly made a big difference to fish supply, to providing employment, to uplifting social communities in many areas. But it, as with capture fisheries, it's not unlimited. And it has side effects. It can cause pollution because you're feeding fish in a locality. It can be associated with spread of disease. It has to be planned in a responsible and far-sighted way. In fisheries, we talk of the precautionary approach. It has to be planned in a precautionary manner. Now, I quite honestly do not know how the planning here is being done. If it is being done in a precautionary manner, then it means they're looking at the potential pollution impacts, they're taking those into account, they're not overloading systems, and they're looking at all the right things. I really don't know. If they're not doing that, then they should be. That's... Right, the question there was, do I have any comment on the Marine Stewardship Council, which is a council initially established by a big company, Unilever, in conjunction with the Worldwide Fund for Nature, and it was promoting a concept known as eco-labeling, where it would label a fishery as being responsible, environmentally, socially responsible. It would label those fish as coming from a responsible fishery, thereby giving consumers who are concerned about such things the freedom to choose fish from responsibly managed fisheries. And in economic theory, they would be able to charge a little bit more and recover some of their costs. Within the intergovernmental debate, that has been a controversial one. And one of the things that has particularly concerned them about eco-labeling is the possibility of using it for setting up trade barriers, using it as an artificial means of protecting internal production from external threats. And this is a very sensitive issue, particularly in developing countries. So anything that looks towards regulating trade, a lot of countries, not only developing countries, but they are particularly vulnerable, are very sensitive to it. So within FAO, we've been given very much a stop-start mandate on that. We're told, go ahead with this, then we're told, no, stop, we don't want it. But now let me give you my opinion. In principle, I think it has potential, and it could work, and it could make a positive difference. If there is an economic benefit to fisheries being managed through having a label, then undoubtedly that could lead fisheries to take, for purely economic interests, to take a more responsible approach to it. So implemented properly, implemented fairly, transparently, I think it has potential. The Marine Stewardship Council has come in for some criticism. At the moment, my own opinion is I'm keeping an open book on it. I hope it works. I hope it does its job properly and beneficially. I think many of my colleagues within FAO would see it the same way. The question was, how would my model apply to the whole debate of genetically modified foods, and is there anything being done within FAO on genetically modified foods? I'm afraid in the answer to the second one, I really don't know. I would think so, but I don't know. It's a big organization that would be coming in under agriculture, and I simply haven't had the opportunity to see what's happening. I would guess if it's not an issue within FAO now, it will be fairly soon. It's the sort of thing where governments would want to come together and discuss the issue, and very often they would use FAO on an agricultural matter for that purpose. In terms of how does my model apply to that, I think very much so. The gentleman over there was saying, I think you could apply the same issues, the same cautions in most fields. Science can provide some of the answers. So we would have to look at that science carefully to make sure it's good science, and it's not science being done purely by the genetically modified companies to promote their products, or it's not science purely done by the environmentalists starting to shut it down. We would have to look very carefully at all the science from those two quarters plus unbiased science in the middle and try and say, what are the risks? What are the real risks? How can we control those risks? At the end of the day, there will probably still be some risks, and there will still be some uncertainties about those risks, and then it's up to the policymakers, transparently and openly, to say, we're prepared to take these risks, but not those ones. That is how I would see it having to go forward. We're going to have to make decisions. Those are decisions that affect us all, so we need to participate in making those decisions within our own countries and within our own fields of interest. Malthusian. The question was, have there been any good examples of science being used, being listened to, and fisheries actually, the managers responding and cutting back catches? Yes, they have. There have probably been quite a few. I'm just frantically trying to think of some. I think the West Australian lobster fishery is one example that is being well managed. There might be an element of luck in all of these, but they seem to have had good catches, sustained catches for a number of years. They seem to have maintained their stock at high levels. The South African hake fishery was one where the stock was overexploited. With good science, they agreed on a rebuilding plan, and they managed to follow it reasonably well. I would suspect there are cases in North America. I think actually the Georges Bank, they've had some good success in recent years through putting in more conservative management measures, through implementing some closed areas, and they've seen some stock recoveries, but there are probably people in this audience who would be able to give more authoritative answers. I think there have been a large number of cases. If we look across the spectrum at the moment, they are in the minority. I think the tide is turning, but at the moment they are still in the minority.
Very much. I think we must stop here. Let us hope that the Australian lobster fishery is reproduced, the successes there are reproduced on this coast. Before thanking our speaker, just two announcements. Next week, Walkerton, Could It Happen Here? Need It Happen Here? Professor Les Lavkulich and Professor Hans Schreier from the Institute of Resources and Environment at UBC. And to let you know that on February the 23rd, Dr. Shirley Thompson, the director of the Canada Council for the Arts, unfortunately will not be here. She's fallen and has broken her kneecap, I understand. Sounds like a horrible accident, but that is the reason why she cannot be here. Now, I would like to ask Dr. Tony Pitcher, who is director of the UBC Fisheries Centre, to thank our speaker tonight.
Thank you, Kevin, for a persuasive and eloquent analysis of the role of science in support of public policy and the problems and pitfalls thereof. It seems the answer is very much a question of balance and uncertainty and understanding those two things. And I can announce tonight that for the first time that in public that Kevin is the receipt of is the recipient of a very important award recently in terms of his balance. Like all good teachers, he teaches his students about balance and extends that tuition to his family members. And recently, two nieces in Durban, he was demonstrating his very good balance on one of those little metal alloy scooters with the little wheels. his balance was such that he was soon the recipient of the award from the Durban Emergency Ward in the Durban General Hospital for the oldest person to fall off a scooter. And the other issue from balance is uncertainty. Well, here on the West Coast, people get some strange ideas sometimes, and we all know the West Coast is the home of such things. And recently, Kevin in Green College, where he's, you know, the visiting professor in residence, is taking advantage of the tuition offered by Green College, and he's been spotted in a seminar on mind reading. So, I hope you'll join with me now in thanking Kevin for his excellent talk.